Never mind all this stuff. It's my pleasure to introduce Mia Consalvo to my left. She's Canada Research Chair in Game Studies and Design at Concordia University. She's the author of Cheating, Gaming Advantage in Video Games. Again, really singular study in game studies and very important for thinking about gaming capital, for thinking about the relationship of games and other media, and also for thinking about politics and ethics in virtual worlds. She's also co-editor of the Handbook of Internet Studies, and she's currently writing a book about Japan's influence on the video game industry and game culture. She's published her work all over. I think we first met at the Association of Internet Research many, many years ago. She's president of the Digital Games Research Association and held positions at MIT, Ohio University, Chubu University in Japan, and the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The title of her talk today is on the screen.
Thank you. thank you for inviting me. And I know I also stand now between you and your lunch, so I will endeavor to be brief. Unfortunately, this is based on a book project, so I will go as quickly as possible. And in case I do get cut off, and I did write a book about cheating, here's your cheat sheet for my talk. All right, so these are the grand conclusions. I will not, you know, do a big reveal at the end. So I'm going to be talking about the player-avatar relationship and how it's complicated. I will be touching on the influence of game platforms and how we need to think about those in relation to what we're studying. And also, and nicely for this conference, the idea of participation and rethinking it in more fluid terms than perhaps, you know, players, play styles, gameplay suggests. And it's also nice because when I first started doing game studies, one of the earliest things I did was a study of women as players. And, you know, at the time, this was like shortly after TL was doing her research, and there was still a lot of attention like, oh, women play video games? How interesting and new. And I've circled kind of a little bit away from women over the years, and now I've come back to them, but I'm sort of looking at them as players, but not so interested maybe in like the gendered nature of their play. I think that there are many interesting things about how they play that do not relate to them just as part of their gender. So the context for this study is Big Fish Games and their now defunct game Faunasphere. If you know Big Fish, they were, or still are, a large publisher of casual games. They mostly do single-player hidden object-style games where it's a big Where's Waldo and you look for items on the screen. However, they did have this game Faunasphere that ran for a couple of years, and I actually talked with them when they were launching it and collaborated with them a little bit to get a little bit of data from them. So that's kind of where the study emerged, and they were interested in who was playing and why and what they were taking from it, and so was I. And I also need to acknowledge Jason Beggy on the left here is my collaborator on this project. We've been working on this now for several years and has culminated. At first it was a paper and then it was two and now it's a book. To give you a little bit of context, if we can, this is just a short video. This is the launch video. I just love that video, and the music is just wonderful. You know, hatch eggs, be a caretaker. It's all wonderful. You know, when you think about MMOs, you're mostly thinking of World of Warcraft and EverQuest and, you know, killing dragons. And here, you're a small animal, and you zap pollution. And that is the conceit of the game. And you hatch eggs to create more fauna, and they, you know, they have these weird genetic things that adapt and evolve over time. And so and that is the MMO. So Big Fish developed this game, As you can see here, it ran for a very brief period of time, and it was designed largely for Big Fish Games' existing customer base, but extrapolating more broadly. So these were largely adult women, older adult women. It launched initially just as a browser-based game, and then about 6 months later, they ported it over to Facebook. It was available on both platforms, and it was a freemium game, meaning you could play it entirely for free, but there were higher tiers of membership where you could get access, you could hold on to more fauna, you know, there was a premium currency that you could use and, you know, play and have more things in the game. This is about as dark and evil as the game ever looked. If you can see it, the dark gray creature is Monty. He was the pollution monster. This is like the one instanced thing in the game. Most of the time, you're just sort of hopping around, you know, as these tiny little creatures zapping pollution, hatching eggs. And the fiction of the game was designed, you know, for this casual audience in mind, right? So what did we do as far as this research? We actually, as I said, worked with Big Fish. So they were nice enough to host the survey and mention it in their newsletter, and their moderators posted the link on the site from them. So we got quite a bit of participation from players, and we got a little bit of usage data, but we also did in-game observation. We did interviews with players. So just to touch briefly on the initial survey to give you a sense of the scope here, we had over 600 responses. We got, as I said, a little bit of usage data. We talked with a community manager. We looked at the forums over the period of the game. Here I will also issue a caveat: if you are studying anything online at all, archive yourself. Don't rely on these companies. As soon as this game closed, the next minute after it closed, the forums were gone. They took them offline. Luckily, we had archived some, but we didn't have everything. And as you can see here, the player base was pretty global, but largely North America. And who played? So this is largely women, adult women, as you can see here, fairly well educated. I have to say, towards the end of the game's lifespan, I had posted, they had a Facebook site, and I had posted a request for interviews, and I think I said thank you to all the women who participated. And one guy piped up, he said, "What about the men?" And I said, "Wow, you know, I've been waiting so long to hear that in game studies. Like, what about the men players?" So these were people who largely had little experience with MMOs. And, you know, a few of them had played World of Warcraft or tried Second Life. There were a few other smaller games or other games that they had played. And I think 8 or 9% said that they didn't know what the term MMO meant. You know, it was largely new to them. So for the genre itself, they were fairly new. However, these were not newbie players in any sense. So just to, you know, go through these briefly, they played this game a lot, as you can see here. So 41% several times a day, 37% daily. Playtime per session, 51% play more than 2 hours at a time. Now, I will point out that this was a non-random sample. These were people who were answering a request to fill out a survey or a questionnaire. These are people who are probably fairly passionate, right? These are the people who either really love or really hate the game. The more casual take-it-or-leave-it crowd, not so inclined to participate. I would say that this is a problem, you know, with a lot of online work. Generally, it's very hard to find those people who are not as committed. But, you know, we need to acknowledge that. And I will just say that with these numbers, you know, you are talking roughly about the same kinds of hours spent as any hardcore player of World of Warcraft. Now, I mentioned it was 93% women, and we asked them what their favorite activities were in the game, and we asked them to rank order them. This is just the top five. There were more of them. But what we were curious about was some of the earlier research about women in these games, and, you know, what they enjoyed doing, and the earliest stereotypes were, you know, women enjoyed socializing and hanging out with people. And TL had already challenged some of that, so we were curious about whether this, you know, held true or not in this game. And as you can see, the only social one was ranked number 5. Above that, completing goals or quests. As I mentioned, breeding fauna was like sort of the main challenge within the game. Leveling up. In order to breed your fauna, you zap pollution to gain experience. When your fauna leveled up from enough experience, they laid an egg. So you did have to level your fauna in order to get more eggs. And you did also have your own private sphere within the game that you could decorate. So that was another activity that these players enjoyed. So these women were kind of going against the stereotype of just being in it for the socialization. So that was the initial survey and just the broad snapshot, and I want to just dive now more quickly into a couple of specific issues. And so obviously, participation is highly contextual, and I want to focus on two things. First of all, temporal issues, I think we haven't seen much of in game studies, and it's important to look at. And the second is platform, especially within games. So regarding temporal issues, we were fortunate in that we were kind of brought in just as the game was coming out of beta. And if you're familiar with online games or even social games, you know that sometimes there's this increasingly perpetual beta period before the public launch. Players are brought in, they're usually invited, you know, via some secret list, and it's to test the load on the servers, it's to find gameplay bugs, it's to get feedback before things, you know, go public. And Big Fish, during this beta period, drew from their existing player base, you know, they're already very loyal customers, and, you know, in one sense, you know, it's free labor for the company, right? These are people who are doing your work for you for free, but interestingly, you know, the players themselves saw this as kind of a labor of love. They were quickly and highly invested in this, and you could see this in how they talked about the beta experience and how they wrote about it in the forums. Now, what's curious is these are people who are new to MMOs. They're not hoppers, you know, from one MMO to another where they're just interested in the next new thing. They really did not know what to do. And they really took this interesting approach to how they understood the game and their role. You know, they did think that they were special and important in providing feedback for the company. You know, so they were these, you know, workers. But at the same time, they were ambassadors, you know, to those who weren't in the beta. They were telling them, you know, here's what's going on, you know, here's what we're finding, it's amazing. And they also developed this interesting culture of niceness, and that's really the only way to put it. They had this, it was like a code of niceness that they posted in the forums, and people would sign it, or, you know, sign up electronically to say, we're all in this together, we're going to help one another. And if you think about the history and cultures of various MMOs, you know that this is not at all, you know, like the dominant practice. But what's really important is not just what happened in beta, but we would argue that this really set the tone for later gameplay once the game went public. And I think that's really crucial for game studies to think about. You know, this early period when you have this smaller group that can kind of codify how things should be done, you know, and set this tone really sets the stage for later play. And so again, just to sort of talk, you know, to sum this up, it really was this kind of pay-it-forward approach, and they really set the tone in terms of how specifically you should interact in the game, what proper gameplay looked at. So I mentioned, you know, you zap pollution and you hatch eggs, so there was zapping etiquette that was kind of informally determined over time. The game, you couldn't freely move around, you would point and click, and players would, you know, sort of develop this system where they would sort of look around to make sure nobody was already zapping that piece of pollution before they stepped in to zap it, because that would be rude by their standards. Also, these eggs that you would hatch, it was better for you to sort of cross-pollinate your fauna, if I can mix those metaphors, and, you know, trade or buy or sell eggs with other players to get the most diverse fauna that you could. And so begging was just, that was a no-no. You should ask politely. You know, there was certainly, there was a market where you could buy and sell, but people were generally open to, you know, it was very much a please and thank you kind of approach. So as I mentioned, and just to sum up, so these beta players really did set the tone. You know, this is kind of how they established play and what proper play practices looked like. And they also importantly, you know, developed this strong ownership in the game. Because they were there, you know, they went through all these technical troubles. They were trying to figure out how the game worked. A lot of the fiction was very non-obvious, not just to a new MMO player, but even we as players, Jason and I, were sort of struggling to figure out how certain things worked. And so they really felt like this was their game. Curiously, they also sometimes challenged the developers, like when the developer said, this is going to be launched soon. You know, it's going to be going up in July. And some of the beta players were like, no, it's not ready. You know, you don't have enough content, and this area isn't fixed yet, and we don't think it's going to draw the customers. So even these people who were very new to the MMO context had gained such a sense of ownership over the game space and pride in it that they were comfortable telling the developers, you know, no, 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 you know, you need to listen to us. We're the experts here. And as an probably inevitable response, once a game launches and goes more public, you have more people coming in, people who are not versed in the etiquette, in the norms that have been developed. And there certainly were norms that were developed, as I just mentioned about like the zapping and the eggs. And so there were these clashes that developed. Some players quickly learned, you know, if I want to fit into this play style, I should be reading the forums and talking with people and kind of listening before I act. Other people felt like, who's going to tell me how to play and why? And, you know, this set up this culture of tension. It really kind of blew up when things turned over to Facebook, which I'll get to in a minute. But, you know, it was an interesting moment, and it shows how temporal, how the temporal can change gameplay expectations. You know, from the new, this is a period when things are kind of in flux, nobody knows how they work, to people figuring out, okay, this is what works best, or, you know, what works best for us, and then launching. And then on the flip side, of course, the new players who did not subscribe felt that the beta players were just clicky and snobbish, right? So there was an in-group, out-group kind of setup. So then it went to Facebook, where Faunasphere encountered the Farmville players. I'm going to not go into this too quickly, but if you've played any Facebook games, you know that they're a very different style of play. And the Facebook launch really, you know, for the original beta players especially, the hordes arrived when Facebook came along. And as you can see here, they were hordes of malevolent children. Some of them really felt that they were kids. I'll get into that in a moment, and it was kids that were the problem. Others, more reflective, said, this is a different style of play, like in Farmville. It's asynchronous. It's more based on just you know, reciprocal stuff rather than communities and trust, and so it's this clash of gameplay expectations. So here's where the importance of platform comes in. If you think about Facebook as a platform early on, and especially the success of Zynga in setting the tone for, you know, what games should look like on Facebook, suddenly, you know, and you could see this in what Big Fish did as well. They created special gifts that you could only get if you logged into the game through Facebook. This angered many of the original participants who did not like Facebook, didn't want to sign up to Facebook just to play this game, right? And they suddenly found that people who were on Facebook were getting freebies that they were not. They felt like there was this new style of play, there were these clash of expectations, these people just expecting to, you know, demand stuff and be given stuff. You can see here, so whenever you went out into the main worlds, there were demands for items from all sides. It became so bad that there were people waiting by the gates to accost you when you came out of your house. And then I never saw one incident of rudeness or the Gimme I Want Brigade until after the Facebook launch. So I mentioned this, I'm just going to skip over this here, but you know, the importance of Zynga cannot be underestimated, you know, in this clash that can that emerged. And then also, curiously, even though Facebook, you know, allegedly you have to be 13 to sign up for a Facebook account, the players really felt like it was children that were the problem. And this is not a new thing in any type of new experience with a game. It's always like the 14-year-olds or the 5-year-olds that are ruining it for everyone. But what was curious is that, you know, these were older adult women. And this is, again, this is a place where gender is interesting to consider. You know, you'd think, I thought, you know, silly enough, well, maybe the women like having kids around, right? No, they didn't. They said, this is my space. It is time for me, either for me to play by myself or with my adult friends. I do not want to babysit other people's children. I do not want them around. They are rude. They do not know the etiquette. They do not care. Leave me alone. And there's really some interesting echoes of Janice Radway's Reading the Romance, and this is a time for me kind of being set up with this game space. So, platforms, I think, are interesting to consider, especially if you're looking at, you know, a game that's existing across multiple platforms or transitioning. Is there a player base? Is there a culture? Is there an expectation or a norm that's going to throw things into chaos? So what came after Facebook? Well, Doom, right? So a few months later, Big Fish announced Faunasphere was going to be phased out. It would be, I think they gave players a month to settle their affairs. And which is not, you know, that's actually pretty generous but from a lot of game companies' standards. So people were predictably upset. you know, this is where I like to bring in that, you know, people say, oh, it's just a game. Well, it was not just a game to these people. We captured some of the posts. People were very upset. They said things like, you know, I'll be missing all of my friends. What, are you kidding me? You know, I can't believe this. You know, people were just outraged. Interestingly here, the social comes back. Remember, it was only number 5. Suddenly the social is a lot more important. People are thinking, oh my God, where am I going to spend time with my friends? We started documenting what were people doing, and here some interesting things emerged in that people started changing their play styles, what they did, how much they played, and again, the temporal comes back because the game is about to end. Some people were so upset that they stopped playing immediately. They just could not go back into the game. Others said it took them a week or more before they could go back. Others started playing obsessively. They were online all the time. They developed goals, you know, for their fauna so that they could get those things done. People who previously just were interested in organizing their spheres became dedicated to grinding to get their fauna to max level. So suddenly, you know, this throws into question again this idea of play styles as static. Things really changed, you know, as stuff came to a close. We observed the sunset. I'm running out of time. It ended. It was kind of lame. There was no really good fiction. And then there's just a screen about how, well, you got rid of all the pollution, and so your fauna are happy somewhere, right? And yeah, it was about as lame as that. But what was curious in coming out of the closing interviews with people was this relationship that they had with their fauna. And I don't have time to go into it here, but just to briefly sum it up, a lot of our research in game studies has focused on players and avatars as this one-to-one relationship. This is my avatar. It is me. It is some reflection in some way. That is not at all what happened in Faunasphere. These were virtual pets that people had. It was almost worse for them when this game closed because they said, like a real pet, you would not just abandon it somewhere, right? And that's what Big Fish made us do. And so there was this really different relationship going on in how the game set up, as you can see here. Look at the premise. It's about naming and raising pets. You know, they gave us creatures to love, and then they told us they were taking them away from us. So, I'm out of time. This is my dog, my real pet, not my virtual pet. But people don't always identify with their avatars. We'll kind of just sum up there and go to the conclusion. So again, fiction is important. We really need to think about platform. We need to think about the temporal nature of a game, either its health, whether it's, you know, closing, whether it's opening, beta periods. These are all things that matter to how people participate in these games. And thank you.